Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion. It's illusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, today our guest is Mr. Vladimir Bukovsky, who is a very well-known Russian dissident, was in prison for a long time in Russia, was a contemporary of Solzhenitsyn's. In fact, I was reading an article the other day, a book, I believe, and they were commenting that both Vladimir Bukovsky and of course, Solzhenitsyn had been released and come to the West. And, well, we've had the privilege of interviewing Mr. Bukovsky in the past. He lives in Great Britain now, trying to get the people of Great Britain and Europe to realize that Europe is developing exactly the same sort of government with central planning and a master bureaucracy that destroyed the economy and impoverished the Russian people. And, of course, if something isn't done to stop this drive towards the European Union, then that freedom as it has existed in Europe and in Great Britain will soon become simply a remembrance of things past. Mr. Bukovsky, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Good to be with you again.
And, of course, we had an opportunity to talk to one of the gentlemen who, of course, had written that book, Blowing Up Russia. I know the other gentleman who wrote that, Alexander, had been your friend, and he was poisoned by the KGB, wasn't he?
Yes. At the end of last year, he was brutally and cowardly murdered here in London.
Well, of course, certainly the current Russian regime seems to be killing more and more of its dissidents, and yet where is the outcry from the American government? Certainly, at least the British government tried to track down the people who poisoned Alexander, but they're never going to be able to get them because Putin will not allow them to be extradited.
Well, we are afraid that the British government now is trying to kind of put it behind them, you know, because they already said that they are more interested in a long-term good relations with Russia than with anything else. So our fear is that they will try to kind of hush it up and not to do anything.
Well, of course, it looks to me as if Russia is moving increasingly back towards its Stalinist roots. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, more or less like that. Of course, it's far away from Stalin's time. At Stalin's time, they would murder millions. We still don't know exactly how many. I mean, it could be anything between 20 and 40 million people being murdered in 30 years of Stalin's rule.
All right, fine. Well, of course, they've only killed a handful so far, but my understanding is that they have actually suspended the voting for the governors. Now they're all appointed by Putin. Certainly, there's very little dissent in the media, and those people who have dissented haven't a fair number of reporters simply been eliminated.
Well, we have reports about journalists, particularly in provinces, being murdered almost every week. We don't know exactly how many people they murdered, but it must be quite a number.
So so many of the people in Russia seem to be quite willing to go along with this. They seem to almost want a strong man. Are we being lied to, or is this really the attitude of many people in Russia who yearn to get back to being a great world superpower?
Well, I mean, you cannot rely on any opinion polls in Russia anymore. I mean, in the beginning of the 90s, when the Soviet Union just collapsed, you could at least rely to some extent on the opinion polls. Well, now they're all in the hands of the government. They're not public anymore. So whatever they decide in Kremlin, the result of opinion polls must be. That's what they report to.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. And our guest this afternoon is Mr. Vladimir Bukovsky, who is a Russian dissident, was imprisoned in Russia for many years, was actually simply exchanged for prisoners, and was allowed to immigrate to the West, and now he lives in Great Britain. And he's trying, of course, to tell the British people, and the people of Europe, as a matter of fact, that this European Union is leading to a massive, unelected bureaucracy, very, very similar to the situation that existed in Russia under the totalitarian regime. Would that be a fair statement, Mr. Mikulski?
Yes, more or less. I mean, we are talking about structures at the moment. I mean, we are not talking about the results. The results are still in the future. But the structures they create are remarkably similar to what we've already seen, and the tendency of development is more or less the same. It looks more and more like an ideological dictatorship.
And, of course, you've written something. We actually carry it. It's called, I think it's EUSSR. And in this, it's a little pamphlet you put together, a short booklet, talking about what's going on and certainly your knowledge. I think some of the things you were able to uncover when you'd gone back to the Soviet Union shortly after the Berlin Wall came down, about the Trilateral Commission, members of the Trilateral Commission, and I think it was David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger, going over to Russia. What was that all about?
Yes, among many documents I've had a chance of seeing, still secret documents, I mean, they're reclassified again after we've seen them. There was one very disturbing and puzzling. It all was about the creation of this integrated Europe, which was a joint project between the European left and the Soviet leaders, a way for them to control anything in between them. And in 1989, I believe in January, a delegation of Trilateral Commission visited Gorbachev in Moscow. Indeed, it was Henry Kissinger, it was Rockefeller, it was Nakasone, and it was Giscard d'Estaing, one-time president of France and later a chairman of European Parliament and many other things. And much later, recently, the chairman of the commission which drafted the European Constitution. Now, that's 1989. At that time, we didn't know about the forthcoming integration of Europe, European Union. Nothing of that was publicly mentioned. And yet, during this conversation, Giscard d'Estaing...
Could you hold that for just a moment as we bring our stations? Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Vladimir Bukovsky, and certainly right after the Berlin Wall came down, why, first, he was able to get over and get the opportunity to go through the files there in Moscow, and he found out that, I guess it was sometime maybe 1999 or so, that Mr. Kissinger and David Rockefeller and Giscard d'Estaing and some of the other elitists from the United States came over to talk to the Russians about forming the European Union. So would you like to go ahead? It was the whole European Union, this joining together of Europe, wasn't certainly there were some people in Europe who wanted it, but the major driving force behind the European Union and behind the American Union and behind the Union in South America and Africa and Asia and the Arab countries has really always come from the United States, using their military and financial power to bring about this union of the world, this new wonderful global system they want. But they were over there talking to the Russians. So would you pick up the story, what you learned, going through these previously unknown records?
Yes, and suddenly Giscard d'Estaing, in the middle of the conversation about the future integration of Soviet Union into financial institutions and the rest of it, suddenly Giscard d'Estaing took the floor and said, well, it might happen in 10 or 15 years, but it's definitely going to happen, Mr. Gorbachev. Europe is going to be a united state, a unitary state, and you would have to deal with that as a new entity. They're very interested, how would you consider that, what your attitude will be to such a development. I mean, this is really puzzling. We're talking about 1989. At that time, the so-called Maastricht Agreement treaty wasn't even drafted yet.
Well, now, was it 99 or 89?
89,
right. 89. Okay.
There was 3 years before we'd heard about this idea of having a close integration into some kind of a union. And 3 years before that, they were already discussing it with Gorbachev.
Yeah, and so this was basically all planned ahead of time. Long-range planning had nothing to do with the desire of the people of Europe or the people of Great Britain. Simply the American elite was going to work with the Russians to bring about this European Union. So what was the Russians' response? Did they favor the European Union? Did they feel they'd be able to exploit that situation?
Well, Gorbachev was very happy about it. He was one of the main pushers of it, if you wish, because he understood how much advantages it will give to the Soviet Union at the time. So he was all in favor of it.
And, of course, you know, if you look into what's really happened over the last decade and a half, American banks provided the funding so that Russia could build this massive natural gas pipeline into Europe to make Europe totally dependent, or at least largely dependent, on the Soviet Union for their natural gas and energy supplies. And this was funded by, of course, American and European banks. And at the time when this was going on, it just didn't make any sense. Why would the United States, and European bankers be doing everything to make Europe dependent upon Russia? I mean, did that ever puzzle you during that period of time? Because it would appear to be totally counterproductive. Why would you want to, force Russia to be, pardon me, Europe to be subservient to Russia?
By the way, one of the main financial backers of that project was Chase Manhattan Bank.
Right, American.
Yeah, Chase Manhattan, the Rockefeller's bank. And that in itself is quite interesting to remember now. They would tell you at that time that it will help us to build a peaceful world. You see, if we are all interdependent on each other, we are not likely to have a war. That's what they would tell you. But the question is how much they did believe themselves in what they were saying. I personally think that they didn't believe in it at all. I think it was just kind of a good excuse for them. More trade, more close relations, less danger of war. But it had nothing to do with reality. The danger of war was generated by the essence of a communist system, which believed that it would liberate the whole world. So whether you're nice to them or not nice to them, that doesn't change in the equation at all. Anyway, so at that time they would explain it by showing themselves as proponents of peace. Well, now we are not in danger of having war. And yet they continue to do the same. Look at Germany. They're now having a joint project with Russia of a new pipeline on the bottom of the Baltic Sea, which would cut off other countries and would make Russia and Germany altogether kind of the main suppliers of natural gas and oil.
And, of course, that natural gas and oil would come from Russia, which, yep, thanks to American help and the Chase Manhattan and other American banks, is now the largest supplier of oil and natural gas in the world. What's even more amazing to me is, despite the fact that Russia has a massive reserves now, about $240 billion in reserves, why we're still giving it money to one guy or another, from the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy, under the name of fighting AIDS, under the name of always an excuse to give Russia money. And you have to ask why the United States seems so intent upon funding the Soviet Union, especially as it becomes increasingly tyrannical. Have you ever wondered why that is? I know you must be well acquainted with the realization that Solzhenitsyn had brought out in his speech back in, I think it was in 75, pointing out that certainly the West has always helped and financed the tyrannical Russian government, and it never could have survived without constant infusion of money and aid from the West, which doesn't make sense.
Well, that's all true. You see, their idea was, ideologically, they were not very different with Moscow. Only Moscow was in favor of more radical, more revolutionary ways of introducing socialism in the world, while the Western socialists would be more in favor of evolutionary kind of reformist way of introducing it. Therefore, the Soviet Union was never treated by them as a pariah, as a murderous state, as a criminal state. It was just some comrades which might be slightly wrong in their tactical development. So that's why they would always feel more close to Russia, to Soviet Union, would always try to soften them up, provide them with cash, provide them with support. Even in the most crucial moments, the Western left would always provide some comfort to the Soviet Union. And now, since they are not called communist anymore, it's even more convenient. Well, they're just a new state. They're striving for democracy. Mind you, they might be very far away from democracy, but that doesn't matter. They are striving for that, and therefore we are entitled to help them all along. Well, I mean, what is behind it, you're asking? Well, my hunch is that behind it is their drive to create some kind of a world government, which would be kind of amicably run by all sides, including the Soviets, the Russians, and the United States, and certain parts in Europe. This is the basic idea behind the Trilateral Commission in the first place. Why did they create it? Oh, how to harmonize relations between these three parts and how to govern them.
But, of course, if you ever did have a world government and it became tyrannical, how would you be able to oppose it if all power was in this one world government?
That's exactly a problem. I mean, for them, it looks nice. In their drawing boards, it all looks very nice and rational and tidy. But in reality, we all know that the planned economy and planned life never works. I've been there. I lived half of my life under a system like that. And I can testify to the point that it never works. It always works wrongly. So if you have it in a world scale, a world government and someone trying to organize it all, then it will be a nightmare. And it will be pretty difficult for us to get out of it because we are not left with any political instruments, any mechanisms of opposing it. So that's why I'm so desperate now to get attention of the people to what is happening, what's it developing. At this early stage, it's easier to oppose. But when it's developed fully, it might be quite difficult to oppose.
And, of course, you're speaking now of what's going on with Europe, with the European Union, and the massive bureaucracy and central planning.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, one of the funny directives we recently had from the European Union, you might not hear about it yet, but you will. They decided to regulate how the people feed cows, because cows emit the greenhouse gases. Now, they calculated that the cattle emits more of these greenhouse gases than the transportation system. So therefore, they are working out what kind of a diet to give to the cows that they emit less of these gases. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but that's exactly what it is. These utopians, one thing is definite, they don't have sense of humor. If they're now forgiving the cow to function normally, forbidding the cow to function normally, well, we will be next, I suppose.
Well, of course, methane is really a very, very efficient greenhouse gas. It's about 20 times more efficient than, as far as reflecting the heat than CO2 is. So, and sometimes they're even saying that, of course, methane is far more dangerous than CO2. So basically, because that has nothing to do with burning fossil fuel. It has to do with what cows have always done. And then what about horses? Certainly, they would fit into the same category. And what about little chickens? You know, they would certainly, that same sort of thing had happened there. They have digestive systems, and certainly termites certainly would give off a certain amount of carbon dioxide from eating all that wood. But I'm sure they'll come up with a law for that.
They're trying to regulate our life to the minuscule details, even including our diet, including what we feed to our domestic animals or whatever. It's already oppressively detailed, you know, and can you imagine how further it will develop in due time?
And, of course, this is what's wrong with the centralized planned economy, and we're moving right in that same direction here in the United States. Well, Mr. Bukowski, is there concern in Europe? Is there concern in Great Britain about the things you and I are talking about? It seems to me that in England today, you have more video cameras, you have more monitoring, you have, you know, in the absolute and total gun control, you have a controlled medium. The average individual there is progressively losing their rights. Are the British people concerned about the fact that I think they have, what, one camera for every 15 or 20 people?
Well, there is a certain concern, particularly among some human rights activists and the groups monitoring the civil liberties. But the population in general doesn't really care about it. They don't notice it. So far, not much of it is felt by the average person in the streets. They will feel more and more of it as the time comes. I mean, there will be prohibitions upon prohibitions. From the summer, this summer of this year, people would not be allowed to smoke in pubs and cafes. That's already we know in advance. But then there will be more and more restrictions, more and more unifications. And now we have more and more restrictions on the freedom of speech under the disguise of so-called hate speech or whatever you call it. It's already criminalized. So before you say anything here in this country, you have to think how it might be interpreted by someone. And would you go to jail for saying what you want to say or not? That's already a fact, a reality in Europe.
And that's really rather a frightening thing, and yet the British people traditionally had a value of their freedom. Certainly America's concepts of freedom came out of the cradle of Great Britain. And yet it seems that the British people have forgotten what freedom's all about, which is limitation on the power of the state over the lives of the people. Certainly this is what liberty and limited government are synonymous. Tyranny and total government is synonymous, and it would appear that in Europe, under the European Union, in Great Britain, certainly which is also under the European Union, they're moving towards total regulation of everything, and yet there's no outcry from the average individual. Is there any organized opposition to this?
Oh, yes. Well, in Britain, we have several good organizations working for that. We have the United Kingdom Independence Party, which on the last European elections in Britain here for European Parliament got something like 17% of popular vote. So that shows you how rapidly it grows, and the party is very new. So even being new, only a few years old, they already could muster 17% of popular vote. So that shows you the degree of concern in the population. But you see, the people's attitude, and I know it by the experience of my life in the Soviet Union, people's attitude is always, oh, well, it couldn't continue forever. It will stop. It's so absurd. It will stop at one point, and we shouldn't concern ourselves with that. It's too absurd. And that's where they're wrong. I mean, in my country, in Russia, they believed it's too absurd to exist for 73 years. And only after 73 years it collapsed. So this attitude, this belief that the things would straighten themselves up, just because it's more natural than what is suggested, this is exactly what prolongs the life of any utopian regime. This is what I'm trying to explain here. Don't wait till it collapses on its own. Do something now. Stop it now. Try to oppose it. Try to limit it. Because the damage done by that will last for generations.
I'm sure you're absolutely right. Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and Mr. Bukowski, of course, was imprisoned for many years in the Soviet Union because he had spoken out against the regime. Now we're beginning to find hate speech legislation passing in our own legislatures in Washington, D.C., totally unconstitutional. But you see, we have people in Washington, D.C., who don't believe in the Constitution. They want to regulate what you say, what you think, what you do. They want to control you from the cradle of the grave and control your children. And they don't want you to have the right to educate your children or to bring them up in the ways of the Lord. That's why they won't allow any mention of God in our schools. And people have forgotten the relationship between belief in God and freedom and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And for Mr. Bukowski, You know, what's happening to religious belief? Certainly, you know, at one time, why England was certainly a very, very deeply religious country. But my understanding is that they pretty well destroyed religious belief in England, certainly in most of Europe, and in Russia as well. What is really happening as far as people's belief in God?
Well, in Britain, the main church used to be the Church of England, Anglican Church, as it used to be called. Now, that church slowly degenerated completely. I mean, first, they allowed the women to become priests under the pressure from feminists. Then they allowed the homosexuals to become priests under the pressure of the gay activists. And it watered down whatever religion is so much that people would leave this church in droves. In Britain now, quite a huge proportion of people either converted to Catholicism or to go to any other denomination, but they don't stay with the main church. And that used to be the main denomination in Great Britain, the Anglican Church. And that is on one hand. On the other hand, there is enormous pressure from the state, from the new legislation, from the European Union, not to have any religion in your life. The draft constitution of Europe, which fortunately didn't pass a few years ago, but would be forced on us again and again, doesn't even mention God at all. Even the Pope protested against that, saying that any constitution starts with God, unless people ideologically are against the God. We have remarkable things here. I mean, in order to be sensitive to minorities, we are not supposed to celebrate Christmas. A lady was fired from her job with British Airways just because she was wearing a small cross on her neck. She was fired from her job for that. And she wasn't really flaunting it around, wasn't demonstrating it. It was on her neck, under her clothes. And even that was sufficient to kick you out. We always have, you know, for example, the symbol of Anglia, England, as opposed to Great Britain, is a St. George flag. It's a red cross on a white field. Now, that is strictly forbidden in Britain to be raised on any public building because it might be offensive to Muslims. It would remind them of a crusade. I mean, Muslims didn't say anything. It's all left-wing idiots here in Britain who raised this question and made it impossible for people to wear what is a symbol of their nationality. That's what's happening here. On one hand, the religion, the mainstream religion, is erodes. On another hand, the pressure from the civil authorities and from new legislation makes it more and more uncomfortable for people not here to any religious faith.
What about in Russia today? I mean, certainly I've heard that, you know, in Russia most of the priests there, or many of the priests, are actually come from the KGB.
Well, in Russia, in the 20s and 30s of the last century, the church was completely destroyed. All churches were closed. All monks were either executed or imprisoned. All priests were imprisoned, and even bishops were either executed or imprisoned. So it went through 30s, and in the beginning of 1940s, when the war with Germany started, and when Stalin suddenly realized that Russian people are not going to defend socialism and kolkhoz and gulag, that they surrender by millions to Germans just to escape his tyranny, then he changed completely. He opened churches, and in a crucial moment of 1941, when he was speaking to the nation, he never said, comrades. He said, brothers and sisters. He was very smart. He was a big demagogue and a good psychologist. He opened the church again. But that was church made in his image, not in the God's image. Every priest, before being ordained, had to be approved by KGB.
Well, unfortunately, the tyrants know how they can use religion, but of course we must never... Our relationship must be to God and not to government. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Mr. Vladimir Bukovsky, who is certainly living in Great Britain now, but trying to sound the alarm, trying to sound the clarion call, so to help the people of Great Britain understand what is really going on in their nation. So you pick the story up from there. Certainly, you know, what are the important things that you'd like to bring forward to our listeners?
Well, there are many important things. Just to try to explain to people who never been exposed to it, never understood it. What is ideological dictatorship? How people are manipulated? How the thought control is exercised? These techniques are not very well known, you see, in the West. The West never was exposed to it, not in full power, only small things they could have noticed, but that was not the experience. After living half of my life in the Soviet Union, I immediately feel propaganda, I immediately feel this kind of manipulation. I have some kind of allergy to that. So that I'm one of the first, like the canary in the mine, which feels the gas before anyone else does. But they would get it. They would, sooner or later, they would get it. My problem is to get them to see it and to feel it sooner rather than later. Because we can prevent the damage. The more we do it now, preventing the development like that, the less damage will be caused. That's what I'm trying to do. I also try to explain to them that passively you wouldn't achieve anything. If you believe you just outlive them and they will go away, you are wrong. Utopians never go away. They only go forward. I always try to explain also that the appeasement never helps this kind of people. The more you retreat, the more you accept their ideology or demands or restrictions they impose on you, the more they will demand tomorrow. So that doesn't help at all.
So how are we going to get the people of Great Britain? How are we going to get the people of Europe? How are we going to get the people of America to value freedom? It's much easier just to go with the flow. And to say, well, things will get better. The pendulum always swings back again. And you, having lived in the Soviet Union, realize that if it swings back, it may not be for two or three generations.
Yeah. And minus, what, 40 million human lives?
Right.
And that's a very frightening perspective for any nation. And mind you, we still don't know, would Russia ever recover? The spiritual damage done to that country is so big that even now, when they could have chosen democracy, they didn't have strength and courage to do that. So that's what happens. You just kill the spirit in people, apart from killing people themselves.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Mr. Vladimir Bukovsky, and certainly in England, in Europe, he is well known as one of the leading dissidents who escaped to the West about the same time as Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and reading the books that I do, you'll find very, very frequently that Mr. Bukovsky is often mentioned. Certainly he was there when Alexander, and you'll have to pronounce his last name because I always tie up on some of those Russian names. Was it Voroshinsky?
Solzhenitsyn.
I'm speaking of Alexander, who was poisoned by the
Litvinenko.
What?
Litvinenko.
Okay, fine. Litvinenko, right. And, of course, you were at his funeral, and I'm sure many of the other people were there. Did you know him well?
Yes, I did know him for more than six years. Ever since he came to the West, ever since he escaped, he came to me, and I was explaining to him the way of life in the West. I was kind of tutoring him, helping him to adapt, him and his family. He has a small kid who is now 12, and that's really our main worry. I mean, how would he take it all, and how would he cope with this loss and trauma?
Yeah, because he knew what he was doing when he defected, and they would certainly set out to kill him.
Of course, yeah. I mean, they threatened to kill him several times. He knew he's kind of on the list, on the hit list. But, you know, the way they did it was incredibly cruel. His death of radioactive poisoning is so agonizing, so cruel, I can't tell you.
And, of course, apparently the reason he broke with the KGB, he had been with them for 20 years. Now they changed the name, but after the so-called fall of Russia, but nothing had changed. The KGB was there. They just gave it a new name.
But that's true. I mean, he told us exactly what was happening inside of the KGB when the Soviet Union collapsed, and how they adapted, how they went into the business ventures, how they begin to be engaged in racketeering of business under the disguise of criminal activity. Many things. He's written a couple of very good books. One of them, I believe, is just about to be translated into English. It's more autobiographical, and there are so many interesting details about this kind of activity in it. So I really recommend people to read it.
Now, that's not blowing up Russia, is it?
No, it's another one. I mean, blowing up Russia is about these explosions of housing buildings, which KGB made and blamed on Chechens in order to get Putin elected, you know, in order to have this war and mobilize population and kind of rally them behind this strong man, so to speak. So it's a more specific book, but the book I'm talking about is the second one which Alexander have written, and it was never published in English. So we hope it will be published now, and it's more autobiographical, and he gives lots of fascinating details about how these Russian secret services operate.
Yeah, but I think it's so important that the American people understand what happened. The KGB wanted an excuse, or FSB, I think what they'd called it, to go to war with Chechnya. So they blew up three of their own apartment houses and killed 300 Russians, and then they blamed the Chechnyans.
Yep.
Would anybody blow up apartment houses and kill your own people just so you could get into a war? And that's exactly what happened, and of course it's not very popular when a member of the ex-member of the KGB writes about how these things are really done. And then, of course, he was ordered to kill Berezovsky, who was a member of the Russian cabinet, and Berezovsky is living over in London today, isn't he?
Yeah, he ran away also in the year 2000, just in time. If he didn't run away, he would have been either dead or in jail like Khodorkovsky.
And, of course, is he living on borrowed time as well? Do you think they're still trying to kill Berezovsky?
Yes, they do. And murdering Litvinenko was a part of the whole thing, because Litvinenko was kind of protecting him and being very experienced field worker. He was very effective in protecting him. So, by killing him, they kind of opened the door, opened up opportunities to murder Berezovsky as well.
But, of course, what really bothers me is that our government is still funding and supporting the Soviet Union. And we're still pouring money in there and into all the Soviet satellite states. Of course, people are never told that. Our corporations and our banks are pouring money into Russia just as they have for almost a century now. And you have to ask yourself why.
Yeah, well, I mean, they increased the investment now dramatically. As compared with the Soviet time, they now increased it probably 20 times, 50 times, something like that. It's massive.
And our banks and our oil companies, they're all over there financing what I believe is, of course, an increasingly tyrannical government. But, of course, our president looked into Putin's eyes and said, I saw his soul, and I knew I could trust him. And I really would far rather that you didn't look into somebody's eyes and see his soul and trust him. I would think you'd see what he was doing and killing people, and then you might wonder if you really could trust this man.
Well, it always puzzled me when George Bush said that, and I remember speaking shortly after that in Washington, D.C., publicly, and I said, well, how did he manage to look into his soul? In all my encounters with KGB officers, one thing I never could spot was soul. So he must be particularly skillful in spotting this kind of thing.
All right, fine. Well, do you have a website or any books or anything you'd like to talk about to our customers and to our listeners here in America or throughout the world?
Well, I do have many sites. One site has all the documents I copied in the secret archives. So I place them all But they're all in Russian, so they're in the original language.
They won't do us a bit of good. Do you have anything in English for those of us who really do not read or write?
Yeah, but as far as the campaigns going against this European integration here, there's a number of good organizations. This is a campaign for British independence. There is a number of sites. If you look at in Google asking Eurosceptics or something like that, you will find hundreds and hundreds of sites and lots of information about how it develops and what it means to the people.
And I think it's so important for our listeners to understand that Europe is moving towards a totalitarian government under, they call it centralized planning, just exactly as here in America we're doing the same thing. Oh, we've got to, and a beautiful example is, oh, we've got to do something that we can't, of course, drill for oil. So we've got to make gasoline and oil out of corn. Well, then, of course, this drives up the price of cattle. It drives up the price of corn. It drives up the price of chickens and of eggs and of food. So, of course, so that the American people won't know that, they have a cost of living index and an inflation index, so they take the food out of that, so you won't know that the price is going up, because if they tell you it's not going up, even though your eyes tell you it's going up, are you going to believe your lying eyes? You're going to believe what you're told. And the end result of centralized planning is always unexpected consequences, and, of course, when you take the individual incentive and control out in competition, you always end up with just disaster. Isn't that pretty well what happened in Russia?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, in the Soviet Union, it was driven into extreme. I mean, everything, every nut and bolt produced in the country was planned 5 years in advance. Can you imagine that? And, of course, that created a total mess in the economy. And, of course, you would never have a right nut and right bolt because you can't plan things like that 5 years in advance. But that was kind of driven to absurdity. But even smaller degree of centralization, a smaller degree of planning, introduces a quite considerable element of rigidity, of lack of competition, of inefficiency, of waste. It's inevitable. The more you plan and control things, the more wasteful and inefficient it becomes.
I remember, I think it was Khrushchev who told this, maybe it was Gorbachev who told the story, about they were going to reward the plant that made the nails by the number of nails they put out. So they made little tiny nails that really couldn't be used, but they could put out an awful lot of them. Well, they said, look, we don't have nails we could build anything with. No, we're going to change that. We're going to, of course, reward you for the weight of the nails, the number of pounds of nails. So they would make these gigantic nails, you know, about 20 inches long because they weighed a lot, and therefore they would get rewarded because they had a tremendous amount of weight of nails. But what are you going to do with a 20-inch nail? And, of course, when you take away, of course, this incentive that you produce for the market rather than produce to be rewarded by the government, you create chaos. And I think that this, I've forgotten which one of the Russian leaders pointed out that these ideas don't work, and yet they continue more or less to this very day, and increasingly being adopted here in America.
Yeah.
Well, would you mind taking calls if I see if we have some callers out here, or if you'd like to talk to Mr. Borkovsky, Mr. Bukovsky, who's really on the front lines of this battle, who understands, of course, what's wrong with Russia. How long were you in prison over there?
12 years.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Vladimir Bukovsky can certainly give you some idea. He's on the front lines of the battle, well-known in Europe, well-known in Great Britain, for trying to educate the people about what's happening. And the average person in Europe can't believe it's really happening there. And then, of course, they're destroying the national sovereignty of the nations without their knowledge and permission. Of course, they're unifying the currency. They're creating a massive bureaucracy that is unresponsive to the elected representatives of the European Parliament, who have absolutely no power. Everything's done by the bureaucracy. And who points that bureaucracy? Mr. Bukovsky, who appoints the bureaucracy there in the European Union?
Well, it's done on agreement between the governments of the member states. But in reality, they appoint themselves. I mean, they create the commission. For example, commission, European Commission, it's 25 members now, exactly the number of member states. Each state is supposed to delegate one bureaucrat to be a commissioner of one or another field, but every nation is entitled to have one. Usually it's done by the bureaucrats who choose whom exactly they would like to be their colleagues, although officially it's nominated by the member states.
But for all intents and purposes, it's sort of a self-perpetuating bureaucracy then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's exactly like Politburo. Politburo was co-opting new members. They were not elected by anyone. They were co-opted. And that's more or less what's happening in Europe. And once they are confirmed, once they're made into commission, there is nothing you can do to them. You cannot sack them. You cannot kick them out. They will be the full term, and then they might prolong their term by the collective decision, and that's it.
And, of course, this is the way that governments work. When they become governments of man and ruled by man rather than ruled by law. Do you think that Putin will actually try to serve out a third term? He keeps saying he's not going to.
Well, the likelihood is that he would not stay for the third term. He himself doesn't want to. I mean, the people around him want him to stay because that would make transition smoother. I mean, they're all afraid of what's happening in the year 2008 when there is re-election of president, re-election of so-called parliament. But, I mean, in reality, it's all controlled now. I mean, there is no elections in Russia anymore. So they shouldn't worry too much. But Yeltsin doesn't want to stay the third term. In my feeling, he just got too tired of it. He wants to leave it to one or another of his buddies, of his colleagues, who are also from KGB, so the corporation would not lose its grip on the country.
And, of course, this is really all a front for the KGB. We know that Gorbachev came from the JVG, and Andropov came from the KGB.
Yeah.
Of course, but why did Yeltsin pick Putin? Yeltsin wasn't KGB.
No. But you see, Yeltsin was losing control over the country more and more, losing support, losing control. And his main preoccupation was to get personal immunity from prosecution for himself and his family when he steps down. And the only organization which could guarantee him immunity was KGB.
Well, now, was this because his family, he and his family, were taking advantage of the situation and profiting from being in government?
His daughter, one of his daughters. I mean, he himself was not known to be corrupt, no. But his daughter, one of his daughters, was notoriously corrupt. And, of course, she would have been in jail if not for her father to arrange this kind of a deal with KGB.
And so Yeltsin made a deal with the KGB, leave my daughter alone, we'll go ahead and put in one of your people. And
yeah.
It's simply go back with KGB control, as it had been for such a long period of time, going back for decades and decades. The KGB was always in control. And it didn't really matter whether they would go through the format of having election, but the Gelling from the KGB always won.
Well, they always had a predominant influence in the country. I mean, the supreme ruler would always be above them, but anything beyond supreme ruler would be subject to KGB investigation and control.
And they were a very, very ruthless organization. My understanding is that you bucked the KGB, why, that they would simply kill you.
Well, I mean, I'm telling you, under Stalin, we still don't know exactly how many, but it's something in between 20 and 40 million people, innocent people who were exterminated.
It's amazing how we always talk about the 6 million Jews, and that was a terrible thing, but we never talk about the 20 or 40 million people who were slaughtered in Russia. I wonder why that is.
Well, I mean, more than that. Recently, the European Commission made a directive that displaying any Nazi symbols in Europe is a crime. Then some former communist countries suggested that the same should be extended to the communist symbols, and it was rejected with indignation by European Commission. So you can enjoy watching Hammer and Sickle or Lenin or whatever, but you can't display Hitler even for Halloween.
Well, that doesn't make sense. You would think that certainly they would want to suppress all of these, if we're going to suppress emblems. Certainly, I don't think that the Nazis were any more tyrannical than the Russians were they?
No. No, and above all, the communism continued in Russia for 73 years, while Nazism in Germany was only for 13 years.
Well, there are lots of unexplained situations there. We're going to be back in just a moment here to wrap up the program today. But certainly Mr. Bukowski knows what he's talking about. He's lived it. He's been in the Soviet prisons. And now he's trying to sound the alarm that what's happening in Europe, what's happening in England, yes, even here. Well, let's go to Larry, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Larry, did you have a question for our guest?
Well, Stanley, it's Larimore here.
Oh, hi. Hi, Larimore. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I had, to tell you the truth, I don't need to get on there, but maybe you can sort of get in my chat a little bit now that I see you're on an ad. But basically, I'm not on the air now, right, Stanley?
Yes, you are. You're talking to the whole world. Larimore Cummings is a physician, certainly one of my best friends when we were practicing. Did you have any question at all for our guest? Or shall I call you back after the program?
No, no, I do, seriously. It's relative to the culture that sustains a certain kind of a government. And you look at Iraq and you look at the culture and you look at what's going on fascinatingly in Turkey right now. The nature of the people, in a lot of ways, the type of government that settles in or endures relate to the nature of the people. So I was going to ask Mr. Kosky to just describe the nature of the Russian people. We hear so much about their government, the old government, new government. What is the nature of the people of Russia? That's what I wanted to hear from him.
Well, certainly, I think the question would be, do you think the people of Russia are ready for freedom? Do you think that they want freedom, or do you think that they really want to be under the iron heel of the all-powerful government?
Well, it's always difficult to describe the national character in so many words. But if I am to describe Russian character, I would rather say that Russian people are anarchical. I mean, they are very kind of difficult to control. So that's probably why the communists have to use such extreme measures to control them, you know. We are not likely to accept tyrannical power. That's why they have to kill us, you know.
That's interesting. I was touring Russia back in the mid-70s, and my in-tours guide was adamant about the nature of the people of Russia really weren't ready for democracy. And I sort of scoffed at it at the time. But then again, I look at the events of today, and the fact is that some cultures and some people aren't.
Well, I think that if any guy told you the truth, you could be from the KGB and they'd end up in the gulag. So remember, when you're in Russia, they're never going to tell you the truth, because you would be a KGB agent.
Stanley, I don't think I ever told you this story, but
we're out of time, but give me a call off the air. I'd love to hear it, Larimore. Good to
hear
you.
I'll do it.
Bye-bye.
See
okay. You. And, of course, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Vladimir Bukowski. And it's a real treat to have you with us. Thank you so very much for sharing your views again.
You're welcome.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, I hope you enjoyed our program. I hope you, of course, want to understand what's really going on. The United States has funded the tyranny of Russia going all the way back to the Russian Revolution. I've read the books Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, seen the video, my interview with Professor Sutton, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, and we're putting that on the DVD, because you need to understand that we funded not only Russia, you know, before the Second World War and during the Second World War and after the Second World War. We funded them all during the Vietnam War. And, of course, we're funding them today. Why would you do that? And, of course, that, of course, is the question that I address in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and that I address in my new talk on Forbidden Secret. And if you look at things logically, for instance, why? During the Vietnam War, were we funding the Russians? Were we funding the North Vietnamese? Were we funding the Viet Cong? Were we killing our boys? Why are we funding in the Middle East today Pakistan that's funding the Pakistani intelligence that's funding the Taliban that are killing our boys in Afghanistan? Why are we funding Russia that's supplying sophisticated weapons to Iran and to Syria that are funding, sending those weapons to Hamas and Hezbollah that will be used against American boys in the coming war in the Middle East? If you sit down and you think about these things, which nobody is ever going to talk about, it doesn't make sense. And if you doubt that we're still, funding the Soviets, you need to get the Congressional Research Report, which I have, and gives the details dated up to 2007. You can pull it on the Internet, available through Radio Liberty. Stop and think, ladies and gentlemen, nothing is as it appears to be. Because we're involved not in a political or ideological struggle. We are involved in a spiritual battle, and there are people within our government who have no loyalty to America. And if you'd like to know who one of the leaders is, David Rockefeller. Read his memoirs, page 405, where he says, I and my family have been accused of being part of a cabal that is plotting against America to bring about a new global order. And if that's the charge, I stand guilty. I am a proud internationalist. His daughter is a close friend of the wicked Fidel Castro, the wicked, enemy of America. It's all as phony as a $3 bill. If Castro's the enemy, why did we send a armed SWAT squad down to Miami, Florida, 125 men with automatic weapons and flak jackets to kidnap little Elian Gonzalez and send them back to Cuba to build up Fidel Castro? You need to see my talk. It's a video. It's called World Revolution, where you'll actually see my interview with the American ambassador to Cuba, who will tell you that we brought Fidel to power knowing full well he was a communist. And as I point out, we've kept him in power, but we can't let the American people know that. We have to have an enemy. If you didn't have an enemy, how would you get the American people to be willing to put out all the money that we put out to protect us from the wicked communists? And, of course, most of those communists would be in Russia or in Cuba. We have to have an enemy. So we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to getting the material that we offer through Radio Liberty. I remember our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please go to our webpage at radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we ask you, of course, to tell others about our programs. If you want to understand why we are in Iraq today and why we're going to be going to war, I believe, with Iran, you need to read my February newsletter. You need to understand that there's a cosmic battle going on, and there's a cosmic timetable, and the people on the other side will tell you all about it. We simply quote from them in my February 2007 newsletter. And then, of course, we hope you'll pray for America, pray for revival, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so, and tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Hello.